on a no-fly list.
As far as the no-fly list,
If you're on that list.
The most problematic thing is that
anyone can be under the investigation of the FBI.
And I know that something really good is going to come out of all of this.
Hey, everyone. Welcome to another week of the No Fly List, where we talk to comedians, artists, musicians, and other cool and interesting people of color. I'm Athir.
I'm Amama.
And today we had comedian, radio show host,
activist,
writer, all-around awesome person, Dean Obeidallah.
He was so cool and so put together. This episode was done through Zoom because it was the like earliest I've been up for
an episode.
Oh my God,
yeah.
It was like 8 a.m. and I was like dying. So this was done through Zoom. But Dean is so like smart and so like cool to listen to. He's done so many amazing things. He was a lawyer. He like writes for
CNN, Daily Beast, MSNBC.
He has
also
like
makes a lot of appearances.
Yeah,
he has his own show, the Dean Obeidallah Show on SiriusXM. He's part of the. I talk about this a lot, but I mean, he's part of the reason I felt inspired and like I could do stand up as a career because he's. Him and Maysoon Zayed, who was a former guest, started the Arab American Comedy Festival, and it's going on like 16 years or something now, and they really put like a lot of opportunities for other Middle Eastern comics. And when I, you know, I used to attend the festival and be like, oh wow, there's other people like me who have similar life stories, and they're doing it. I'm like, maybe there's like something I could do with this.
Yeah.
So that was really inspiring, and he's such a hard worker.
He's just like a overall great dude, great vibes. He had so many fun stories to tell us. And also, like, he did do comedy full-time for a few years. He talks about quitting his job and making that leap. And he's also just so helpful to other comedians. And I think that's, like, really dope, especially in an industry that people are, like, beyond competitive and can be awful to each other.
Oh, yeah. No, he's always been really awesome. And he, you know, he's been doing this for a while. And, you know, I remember in the beginning, I would always ask him for advice, like, you know, what should I charge for, you know, this or what is whatever? When people, you know, used to ask me questions in the beginning or like when I first started doing stand up, he was just like super, super helpful. And, you know, he talks about how you really got to go after your dream. And no matter what you're doing as your full-time job, if comedy is a calling for you, then you just got to follow that.
Yeah, no, I definitely agree. Yeah, I think also he just seems like the type of person that I would want to have coffee with and pick his brain. And I think after this episode, you should like follow him and look at all the cool things he's doing. But he's like really lived multiple lives. And I think that's like especially pretty dope.
Yeah. And also, you know, we talk about his background. You know, his dad was an immigrant from Palestine. His mom is Sicilian American. And he grew up in New Jersey, not too far from here.
Yeah.
So it was just really cool to hear about his life and how he came to do comedy. And definitely check out all the things that he's done. He also co-produced the movie The Muslims Are Coming, which is really awesome. He did the Axis of Evil comedy tour. He's done so much. And he's just such a nice, down-to-earth, wholesome person that you're just like, oh, he's just the best.
Yeah.
He's so funny. And I could, you know, he's so great. And I could listen to him chat all the day. I remember when, you know, he'd take me on the road with him, he would just be telling funny stories the whole time and chatting. And you guys will definitely hear that on the pod.
But before we get into that episode, we're going to get into our first segment called the No Fly List. And this is where we put people on our shit list. Our no-fly list instead of innocent brown people. So this week we have people who are returning to restaurants or who have already returned to restaurants and have been absolute nightmares to be around. And I have a lot of friends in the restaurant industry. I've seen this happen. People aren't tipping enough. They're being really demanding. And we only had like a year in quarantine.
Yeah.
I'm nervous about what happened. Like, what were you guys doing in your homes that you think that you could treat service workers like absolute shit?
That's horrible, especially after a pandemic. It's always horrible, but now restaurants are understaffed. People are underpaid. They're walking out in the middle of their shifts.
As they should.
Yeah, it's so stressful. And it's physically draining. It's mentally draining. And then have to deal with your cheap ass and demanding self. No, you better tip people. Over tip. I mean, no matter how bad the service is, I always tip 20% at least.
Oh my God, absolutely.
I feel terrible. I'm like, I'm sorry.
Look, last week someone like dyed my hair brown again, and which was not what I wanted. And I was like, 25%. Thank you so much.
I always tip any like the waxing people or like that. Well, I'm like, I'm so sorry. I have to touch my feet or like when I have to do a pedicure or something.
Yeah,
or waxing,
as you should.
I'm
like,
tip. Just tip people well, especially in the service industry. Because we're all struggling out here, and that's just already it's an unstable environment right now for all jobs, but especially something like that. And just be nice to them.
Be nice. Like there's like obviously like people are short staffed. They're running around. I've seen one of my like closest friends. She works at a really dope place that you guys should actually go support called the Ryerson. My other friends.
Oh, it's so good.
Yeah, it's
the
so good.
It's amazing.
The people who own it are some of the nicest people ever. So please go check it out and also go check out Two Saints. But again, people are short staffed. A lot of like in the beginning, like as they were hiring people, some people like quit and didn't show up. And then they're like, there's just so much going on. Great food, but it takes time to get that food out, especially when you don't have a lot of like staff. And man, I saw people being really rude, particularly one instance where I was just like dropping something off to them. And these girls were like, so like, can we just get like a picture on the house? Like, do you guys do that? And it's like, no, bitch, they
drinks.
Do not do that. Yeah. And they didn't really tip. And they like left on like a really expensive bill of like multiple pitchers, and it's like, guys,
that's fucked up.
Yeah,
that's really fucked up. Yeah, just be a decent person. It's not that hard.
Yeah,
tip, be nice. Listen to this episode, support us.
Yeah,
support Canal Street Market for letting us be here as we record the intro and enjoy. Yeah, thank you. Welcome, Dean, our earliest guest ever.
Great to be here at 4 a.m. I mean, it's really enjoyable.
You're used to, I was going to say you did morning radio, didn't you, at some point? Or no, or you
not,
do night radio?
That wasn't.
I've done your 6 to 9 p.m. show.
That's another half hour, half Italian guy. No, I only did, I did 6 p.m. to 9 p.m. now. I did a noon show for a while, for a couple of years, and then 9 p.m. to midnight for like 5 months, which was awful. But now my show is 6 to 9 p.m. on Sirius XM. So that's what I do. But I've been on morning radio countless times, plugging when I was touring and stuff. That's just the life of being a comedian. You're always doing that kind of garbage.
Yeah. This is like honestly the earliest that I'm supposed to work at 8 a.m. And still I was like, oh my God, I haven't actually
most to wake up at 10.
Yeah. I'm
just working from home. So I was like, oh yeah, like no one's going to really check in unless my boss is listening. Then like, just kidding. But when I woke up.
In which case, please rate us and subscribe.
But today when I woke up, I was like, what is this? What time is it?
What kind of torture is this? What kind of Guantanamo Bay is this that you would make me wake up this early? Well, I woke up early. I have written an article. I refinished some cabinets. I've designed a whole summer house to live in.
I believed you,
Dean. I made my own.
You do give off that.
Your hair too, like everything. You look so put together.
You're very put together right now.
Yeah, you know, I'm sorry. It's what I do. I work in this thing called the entertainment industry. So when you go on camera, you want to kind of look good. But look, you do what you want. You guys live your life.
Need a mama rolled out of bed. I'm still having my coffee.
Imagine though if I was like, wait, but I put in effort with the way I look.
Yeah, you're like, this is me. This is my glow up. What are you talking about, dude?
No, I wake up.
This is the best we're ever.
I wake up, I go to bed with goop in my hair, and I have it instantly. I have people apply to me as soon as I wake up. They go like, you're a little low on Bumble and Bumble. I'm like, okay, fix me up. And then I leave my bedroom because I don't want to, God forbid, I walk around in the halls of my apartment building and someone goes, oh, Dean, what happened? You used to look good. And I'm like, I look good all the time. This is what I do. It's actually a filter. I have it set on 1998 on Zoom.
You have not changed in the time that I've known you or that I've known of. He's like looking like, no. But yeah, I think it's, I can't remember the first time I came to the Arab American Comedy Festival at some point. I mean, that's been going on, like, we're on 15, 16 years now.
17, it'll be maybe 17 years.
Oh, wow.
Amazing. I think I've done the last six or seven. Yeah.
Did you, what, like, so that was just like your project and you started that?
Well, Maysoon Zayed was sort of involved.
Who was a past guest. Maysoon. She's been on the pot. Yeah.
Created in 2003. But you know, it's funny. We're coming up to the 20th anniversary of 9/11. That festival was created because of, in response to 9/11, because all the media then was just horrible about Arabs. So we created the New York Arab American Comedy Festival to show that we had arts and we could be funny. We couldn't even get enough comics to fill the show. There were not enough. We begged the comic from two that we knew in L.A., Aaron Kader and Ahmed came, and one in Chicago. In fact, I think they came the second year. The first year, that may have been the second year. It's hard to say. I can't remember now. But we had to beg them. And we actually had like comedic actors who were Arab American host the shows stuff because we didn't have enough comedians to fill the shows. It just wasn't enough. And we was in every show just doing the same jokes because we were all newer comics. I mean, I was in comedy a couple years before 9/11, but more just like open mics and stuff. I was not a professional level comedian. And so was Maysoon. And we put this thing together. Like, we have to do something to be activists to show our community in a more positive light.
Yeah. I'm like, I thought for a second you were going to be like, yeah, we started it on September 11th. And
the festival every year is on 9/11. Why can't we get anyone to show up?
I remember it was like an hour after 9/11. I called Maysoon. I'm like, you know what would be good? How about a comedy festival?
You know how we can use this?
I was going to say, Dean, like, are you like a New York native?
No, I'm from Jersey. I live in Jersey. Oh. I'm from North Jersey. So I went to college and law school here in New York City. And my whole life's been going back. My whole life, I've lived within 12 miles, you know, because I'm from Paramus, New Jersey. And I live in Manhattan. It's literally 12 miles away. But my entire existence, if you said that about another part of the country, you would seem so like homey or parochial that you've lived your little cute life within 12 miles of where you were born. But considering it's New York City and North Jersey,
but it's
a
New
little
York,
different,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
In Alabama, Theo, if you were born in Alabama, your entire life, 12 miles of Alabama where you were born, it's a different life than the life I've.
Oh, boy. Totally. Or Palestine. But in Palestine, you can't travel within 12 miles. So that wouldn't really happen. You'd be within like 12 kilometers of like where you were born. But yeah, I hear that so much. And actually, that makes me happy that people still love New York or being in around the East Coast as someone that moved here like now maybe going on 13 years.
Wow.
But I still like talk to native New Yorkers or people who lived here their whole life. And they're like, yeah, I love it. I don't know if we're all deluded or if it is the greatest city or if we just as entertainers, I think, or as stand-ups especially, I think it's hard to find a place that is going to give you as much or as
it definitely for comedy. It definitely is. I grew up in New York. And then I went to Providence, Rhode Island to like teach for a few years. And I did public policy stuff there. And man, it took me, I think, 2 years to actually love the city. And the first year though, I was a mess. I was like, why does everything close so early? This is horrible. And like, even when I started stand up in like the Boston area, I was like, no, I like nothing compares to New York. There's just, it's so hard to find so many people that you love and hate so much. We're Rhode Island, everyone is nice, but they're not nice. Like, it's just like a weird.
Same in Alabama. Yeah. Yep. It's more like people are polite, but they might still be racist.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Racist. Yeah.
I'm from Jersey.
Not everybody.
We're just like New York. I mean, Bergen County, where I'm from, which is literally the suburbs of New York, it's the same. I mean, it was not like they were really nice in New Jersey. When I crossed the bridge, they became rude. It's the same people on both sides.
Yeah.
There's nice and there's rude. But what I like about New York City is that no one asks me to speak slower here. And no one says, can you repeat that? What did you say? When I leave this area, I speak fast. I'm a fast talker. New York, I fit in perfectly. Also, I'm neurotic as hell. And New York, that fits in well. Like when I'm online at Walgreens or Duane Reed and it's taking more than 5 minutes, you know, people online, we make eye contact. Like, what the F is this? What is going on? But the suburbs, you just wait. Oh, I guess it's gonna be 15-minute wait. You're like, what are you kidding me? 15 minutes? Like, I'm leaving. I'd rather go to another Walgreens 15 minutes away which may or may not have a line, then wait 15 minutes here where I can definitely be served. And that's the New York attitude. It's also the North Jersey attitude. It's a fast-paced life, and I enjoy that very much. I don't like sitting still. I don't have downtime. I'm literally writing an article before we started this. When I go back, I'll finish it for MSNBC about, because I'm always working. I mean, I enjoy working. Either used to be much more about comedy. Now it's a little less about comedy and more about media, but I'm still trying to write jokes, carve out time daily, or at least 3 or 4 times a week to sit down and try to write some jokes. I like staying active. I find downtime. It's not like the devil's work. It's not like I'm going to start doing heroin or something. I just don't find it. Like, if you give me
such an extreme.
I either write an article for MSNBC or I do heroin.
He's like, sometimes I do cocaine, but you know what? Like, that's just when I'm writing the article. But
you give me 20 minutes.
No wonder you're up so early and you talk really fast.
Yeah, this actually makes sense.
All starting to add up. Heroin.
No, you give me 20 minutes and I'm making crystal meth. That's what I do.
You are very efficient.
I'm baking it. I'm putting it there. I'm watching Breaking Bad to learn how to make it again. I got my van downstairs. So.
This is why brown people are so like fucking driven. It's like we're not just watching Breaking Bad just to watch it. We're like, how can I do this?
Let me learn something. Let me be an entrepreneur. Let me learn to sell.
I think it's the immigrant work ethic I get from my dad. My mom is born here, but her parents are immigrants. My mom's kind of lazy. My dad passed away years ago, but had like 3 jobs. He was working all the time. So I get that from him, from that side. I don't know why.
And your dad's Palestinian, right? And your mom is Sicilian, yes, right? Is
that correct? And
you were, correct me if I'm wrong, I think you told me that your dad or your parents were in the restaurant industry, because my parents were in the restaurant industry. And
my dad was a cook. He came here from Jordan. He was born in Palestine, but he then moved to Jordan, then came here and worked as a cook, and then worked in restaurants, and then opened up a diner in New Jersey on Route 17, which we owned for, I think, maybe 10 years, a 24-hour diner, which was life-sucking because my parents were working all the time there. My mom worked a lot there, but my dad worked all the time. And then I worked there as well. So yeah, we were in that business. And
that was our family, but I was much younger. Yeah. So you worked there as well.
What kind of business would they have?
They had an Arabic restaurant, which they called Lebanese because it sounded more appealing in Alabama than Palestine. People would have no idea. So it's Lebanese. I'm like, you could just say Mediterranean cuisine, but then my parents would, like, the business did really well, but then it could have done so much. It was soul sucking, and they worked. I remember, like, sitting in that room, me and my younger brother. My older brothers worked there. Me and my younger brother would just sit in this room watching TV. We were like kids. Like, I was like 6.
Arabic TV?
He was a baby.
Is it TV?
No. Right, it was just Lebanese. We were only allowed to watch Lebanese cartoons. Very fancy little French Lebanese cartoons, right. But it was soul sucking for like 5 years, and they didn't sell alcohol. And that, I remember that being a big thing of them being like, you know, if it's not going to do as well if we don't sell. They didn't sell alcohol. My dad's like pretty conservative. And now I look back on it, I'm like, you guys could have been like super successful. It's like, just open a bar, you know, why not? Like,
the profit margin on drinks at restaurants and stuff is really good. I mean, that's really, they make so much more money on that. So yeah, you could have had drunk white people eating falafel and making all the bank. Your family would have been like,
look at Mamoons. Like, my mom's cook, it's like incredible. But if there was just like a, I mean, Mamoons like a fast whatever, but yeah, drunk white people eating falafel. That's really what happens on McDougal. And but yeah, I think I'm glad. And then they did like different businesses, like hair beauty supply stores, like stuff like that.
They went to
my mom's a hairstylist.
A hairstylist?
Yeah. Well, my mom's actually a hairstylist, but she does it all. She's an amazing.
I was gonna say,
cook.
Like, your mom just clearly was like, I could do whatever I want and just like have.
I think
like
she's actually Dean's mom. I think Dean.
Oh, yes.
Actually, she's a huge fan of Dean. She was like, I'm gonna send this to her.
My Sicilian mom. I mean, the philosophy was vastly different. My mom's philosophy as a Sicilian is, if you want something, you have to go take it, which we call shoplifting. But that's what she would tell us. My dad's
like a really white person thing to do, though.
He would say, no, if you want something, you have to go after and take it. My dad's philosophy is, if you work really hard, you'll get rewarded. And I think in America, the reality is that I put the two of them together. I think you have to work really hard, but you have to go after what you want. My mom used to say all the time, no one's going to say, oh, hey, you're a nice boy, here's something. And she's right. Nothing. Anything. You have to fight it. You have to demand it. And
especially for like people of color, there's no way that like, they find, if white people find one person of color and they're like, we did it, here is diversity. So it's like, you do have to really like fight for what you want. And man, like I like learned that when I was like in Rhode Island, and I was still like the only like brown like comic. And I was just like, no, I had to like still like fight so hard for like everything that I like want to do, because people are like, all right, cool, we gave you this and we gave you that. And it's like, no, you can't just do that.
I actually fight to keep other brown people out now. Like, I'm the only Muslim hosting a show at SiriusXM, and I tell the executives, I go, I'm not going to keep it that way. Okay, I am the only Muslim hosting a national radio show at SiriusXM. There'll be no other. No, I mean, I'm kidding.
You've killed, because you killed them all. I won't let people have tried to come up the ranks.
I out them. I'm like, these are
they
not.
They just disappear. And he's like, I don't know what happened to them.
It's interesting, though. Like, there are people in our community who are really helpful of others. And I don't even mean just in comedy. I think comics are generally fine and helpful. But in the bigger issue of media and in society in America, there are Muslim Americans that are really helpful. And there's others that are so horribly competitive that they're toxic. And I've learned to stay away from them. But I didn't expect that. You know, I learned that. I'm like, wow, this person's really being horrible. And you learn why.
I think we all learned that the hard way, in one way or the other, with one person. I would say, though, Dean, I really feel like in stand-up, people are the least helpful.
The least helpful?
The least helpful than other careers. I think with stand-up, especially with people of color or with women, sometimes they also make us feel like we're pitted up against each other, because and that there's only this like one spot. So a lot of people, I think, are hesitant to help rather than see it as, hey, there's a piece of the pie for everybody. Yeah. So I think it just depends on that person's like perspective on it.
Recently, I think, with like last year's conversations around like Black Lives Matter, and also like a lot of people realizing like some of the oppressive things that they had gone through when they were younger. my God, my voice cracked. And
wow.
Going yeah, through awesome. Puberty.
Fucking under you.
It's yeah. hard to do a show at 5 a.m.
Not really fun.
But I've talked to a lot of like brown guys recently who are like, we want to like start to like be like, we have to like lift each other up, because like the boys have each other, but we really need to do this. So I'm hoping that like that changes. But of course, like there's always going to be newer people coming in, and like newer people are like, no, I will be the person who's going to be like the most like, I don't know, like sought after this, that. And then after a few years, you're like, no, you need each other. You need that community to like uplift you.
Definitely. And I will say, I have to mention, of course, like Dean has given me my first opportunities, like some of my first paid opportunities, not just like the Arab American Comedy Festival, which then allowed me to like perform at Gotham. And I was like going from like, yeah, just like doing little shows and open mics to like 300 people at a sold out show. And then Dean took me on the road with him and let me open for him. And that was like, that gave me the confidence and to continue that momentum. And I think that Arab Fest was like a turning point in my comedy career, because that's when I took it really seriously, because I'd been dabbling with it a little bit. And I didn't think I was like as good or that I could do that. And so
your parents are going
to
blame
me. I'm just here to thank you, Dean.
Your parents blame me. It's like, that's the one.
Yeah, you're the reason. Yeah.
The reason I like producing is that, like, if you're just a comic, you're just rooting for yourself. But when you're producing, you're rooting for everybody in the show.
Yeah.
You want the show to be good. So for my own personality, I enjoyed that part of producing a great deal, where it's like, we're all in this together. And I'll watch the shows. And if someone doesn't do well, I actually feel bad for them, and I feel bad for the show. I'm like, oh, what happened there? It's not like the biggest deal in the world, but I do. But it makes me root for the show and everybody in it. And so I like that, because comedy is competitive in that you're on stage alone and you are competing with other people. I mean, it's in this industry's eye. It's interesting. It's an interesting field. I mean, I'm glad there are comics who are helpful. There's going to be some that are not. In the media, some things, I won't say names, but there are some Muslims who have been so helpful, and others who have been, they've been competitive and almost putting me down and stuff in the past. I've kind of outgrown that now. It's not really an issue, but you're like, wow, you're just, in their own view, you were a competition. Or there were some people who I didn't even know who were in our community who want to be in the media more and couldn't, and then would lash out at me and call me things, stuff like that. I'm like, I don't even know you. Why are you upset with me? And then you talk to them, and it turned out they wanted to be in the media. And I would always say, I'll try to help you be in the media. I'll do what I can and introduce you to bookers. It's not, there's so much room out there. It's not just like me.
Yeah.
But look, I mean, there are This is human nature.
Well, you've helped Nina. Nina Haroof is one of our past guests as well, and good friend. And, you know, you've another Palestinian comedian, young comic. So you, she was a producer on your show at SiriusXM for a
still bit. Works
at, she still is. Okay.
Sort of. Yeah. She works. It's so funny when Nina goes on stage and talks about.
She calls you her son.
Right. No, no. She goes on stage and reveals how she goes to work high and all these things. They go, you work for me. I'm like, you're just telling the audience. I'm like, I didn't know that. So I have to watch to see what she's bad at work. She goes,
oh, no.
Oh, like in the last show, she's like, yeah, and working from home. And I pretend I'm working and I'm watching TV and I'm not doing anything. And I go, to them, it's funny. But to me, like, you're talking about what you do on the show. I mean, this is ridiculous. And she goes, I still do my work. Then I'm like, oh, I have to watch her act for like confessions. It's like I have to give her a review after the show. About her work thing.
You're like, she's like, I don't know if you like Conan O'Brien's assistant, where like they would just do interviews and she's like, yeah, I work sometimes. And he's like, you're just watching TV at work. And that's your relationship. I like that.
But she's gotten to be a really good comedian now. She's developed. And I would talk to her all the time. I'm like, did you go on stage? Did you go before? And, you know, she's really getting to the point where I'm rooting for her to get even better at comedy so she can leave the show. Because there's a point where you have to make that break. Where you have to say, I'm going to do this as a career. There's no one who's like a lawyer and dabbling like in landscaping or working in landscaping and going like, I'm actually a lawyer a few days a week. I really want to be a full-time lawyer. Whatever career, like if it's your, it's either your avocation or it's your vocation. Like it's either what you're going to do, it's going to be your hobby. It's going to be your life to be a comedian. You got to go full-time at some point because it's just too competitive a field. You can't do comedy a few nights a week. Because I know that firsthand. Like Bonnie McFarlane told me years ago, and I don't know, you guys know Bonnie McFarlane?
Mm-hmm.
Comic. We were doing some gig when I was still a lawyer. And she goes, and we were both pretty young then. And she said to me, like, I don't know if you're going to make it as a comic, but I can tell you, if you remain a lawyer during the day, you're never going to make it. She goes, that's for sure. And I thought about that. And she was right. That's why I didn't quit being a lawyer from that pep talk, but it made me think about what
that
you
day
want.
You go in
and here.
Quit.
Why are you McFarlane? You don't know her. She was middling at Governor's, but she. So
she thinks I got something. She told me I need to quit.
She didn't say I got anything. She didn't go like you're special. You're going to be great. She just said like you're never going to make it if you remain full time as a lawyer and do comedy a few nights a week. And that's
you won't have a shot.
Yeah,
yeah.
You have to give yourself a chance.
It is all encompassing. So are you saying that eventually you would like to, you know. Kind of transition out of the media or like SiriusXM stuff and then do more like stand up.
No, I was a full-time comic for years and years. It was fun, but that was a different time in my life. I was doing full-time comedy for probably 12 or 13 years where I was just traveling all the time and getting bookings. And there's a lot of stuff in the Middle East, but we go through, I think life is a journey in terms of your career and what matches up with your life. And you know, I had been a lawyer. I worked at Saturday Night Live. You know, I was a page. I've done a lot of garbage. I've done a lot of things, good and bad, in my life.
Did the Axis of Evil comedy tour, which was amazing. I remember watching that in Alabama with my family. So it was kind
that was
of
fun. That's when we were doing it full time. We were touring all the time. But the idea of me now going to travel all the time is not appealing on any level. I like making people laugh a great deal. I really enjoy it. But as I've gotten older, I still, you know, you want to do things that are. That you think you can make a difference on issues. So the media lets me do that, about writing articles that are serious. And on my show, I can be funny or serious, but I feel like I'm doing both. But I still enjoy comedy. Like if I could go do some weekend touring here and there, I would. But to make my living full-time again as a comic?
Oh, that's exhausting.
That is. That's
too.
Like, yeah. I think also like the pandemic like taught people what they might really want to do. And I think like for like, I started to like write a lot of like political satire during the pandemic. Cause I was just like, I don't know where else to like put all of my anger and I still wanted to be funny. So I was like, well, this is what I'm going to do now. And then like from there, it's like interesting, like the opportunities that I like got to submit for, I was like, oh, like actually I think in the long run, this might be my path. And like, I love stand up and I like right now over the summer, like want to do a lot of stand up. I know like a lot of comics I've talked to have been like, I don't really know what my path is right now. Like the pandemic, like helped me realize that like maybe like full-time stand-up was not for me. And like, yeah, like this might be. So it's been like, and I've had a lot of these conversations the last few weeks. So it's just like really interesting to see like what's come out of it and like how people are responding to like what they did the past year.
I'm a professional Zoomer. I just do these Zooms and I get paid a percentage of the podcast. I'm sorry, I don't think I told you guys this. You know, in April, we just covered this on my show, in April, nearly 4 million Americans quit their job. That's the most in the decades of the Department of Labor keeping that record. So there's something going on in our society where during the pandemic, people reflected on their lives. And now that we're coming out of it, they're like, I'm worth more, or I don't want to I want something better out of life. And I think a lot of times people don't ask those questions. Like I ask those questions all the time. That's why I quit being a lawyer. I'm like, what do I want out of life? I kept asking that question. And I think a lot of people don't. And finally, the pandemic made them slow down and be more introspective and reflective on what do you want out of life? And are you getting paid enough in your career? And do you just want to, because, you know, you get a job that you think is temporary, and before you know it, 5 years and 10 years have gone by and it's your career and it might not be the career you want. And I've always been such an advocate for people to go after your dreams. You know, when I was younger, there was these quotes by people like Henry David Thoreau, who's a philosopher, and Ralph Waldo Emerson. But Henry David Thoreau talked about the mass of men live lives of quiet desperation. And this idea that you live your life silently, desperately, yearning for something better, and you never go after it. And I refused as a young man to allow that to be my life. Or like people like Robert Frost, a famous American poet who talked about, you know, the road, two roads in the woods, and he took the road less traveled, and that's made all the difference. I think you have to be, there are a lot of people who don't want to be truthful. I call them
people are afraid. Yeah, afraid, because once you are honest with yourself about what you want, and like I literally broke down in therapy when I said out loud after like a year that I'm a comedian and that's what I want to do, because then I felt this burden, sense of responsibility to go after it, and that was scary as hell.
Well, you can just live in denial like Trump supporters. It's even better, right? Our life's perfect.
I live in denial with other stuff. I but with comedy, I had to like be upfront.
It's also though, like,
but I also,
no, I was gonna say like a lot of times, like it's, especially if you're like, oh, I want to follow my dreams. Like there's just so many things that you can make excuses for. Mm-hmm. And like I right now, like the job that I have, it's like Papa's factory job is back. So part of me is like, okay, like now that everyone's like back on like their foot and I'm not like the only person like making money, like my job's getting harder. And it's the same where I'm like, I don't want to do this. I don't like my day job. Clearly I'm supposed to be working and I spend all day writing. And now they're like, come back to the office. And I'm like, how am I going to write all day? And I have like a planner. I'm like, I'm going to bring my laptop, sit in a corner and just be like, I will like do my thing. But it's just, again, if someone's
that's funny. For work,
that's what I did for years. When I worked in this like little office and this little cubicle. And if my old boss is
when I was a lawyer,
I don't care.
When I was a lawyer, there were times I would close my door and write jokes for like a half hour.
Yeah.
And like, I'm like, I've got to do this. And people who become comedians, look, there's something wrong with us. I mean, if you're a full-time, there's something, whatever it is, whatever your parents didn't hug
something
you,
is off. Right,
your parents didn't hug you, you didn't get the attention you needed. You have
or too much attention.
Whatever it might be that drives you to go to the stage, then it becomes the work. And you have to work hard. And it's about writing jokes and recording jokes, recording your sets and listening and crafting an act and not being lazy and not being taking the easy road with comedy and doing hacky jokes. But it really is a remarkable calling. I mean, comedians, I've met many famous comedians who in 10 seconds are just comedians. Like I remember talking to Robin Williams, who was in a play, Hen, my fiance, was in a play on Broadway, and Robin Williams was in, and met him a couple of times. We would talk. And in 10 seconds, he went from Oscar winner to just a comedian talking about spots in the city. We're a unique breed. Like if you make your living doing comedy and traveling, we instantly have something in common through a unique experience that most Americans, like a wartime thing, you've never gone through. And it's a band of brothers and sisters at its best. But at its best, that's what it really is. That's where you have this common bond.
Yeah, for sure.
It's like we're in the trenches together. Yeah.
Fighting each other, though. Oddly enough, we're shooting each other as opposed to outwards. We're in the trenches.
Exactly. Yeah.
Well, yeah, I think that's like the thing. It's like you need to like be better than yourself. And that's like we're like listening to everything and like actually like actively like everything I submitted to over the pandemic. Like I love like the people who like published me, but now I'm like, all right, I've always wanted to be in the New Yorker. How do I get to that level? Like, you have to like keep competing with yourself because anyone else, like, who gives a fuck? Like, they're not going to do your act. It's just you doing your shit. And I think we forget that sometimes because the world is like, look at that brown person. Why aren't you better? It's like my mom when she's like, look at your cousins. And I'm like, no, I don't want to.
You got to push yourself. You're not going to. And if you're not going to believe in yourself, how can you expect others to believe in you either? So there's so many closed doors. And for anyone, regardless of your industry, but I've always looked at rejection as no for now. Like, it's just no for now. And at some point it'll be a yes. And I saw that with comedy. All the clubs that didn't pass me for years, then all passed me. And I worked all there. And then it was no big deal to work at the clubs. Take that for granted. And other things in the industry, oh, my first TV credit. Oh, it's so good. And you start doing TV somewhat regularly in different forms. And you're like, okay, no big deal. What's next? And if you're not pushing yourself, there's no one else that's going to push you. Like, your agent or manager might a little bit if you have them, but it's really up to you. If you don't self-motivate, nothing happens.
Yeah. Well, Dean, we have our first segment, which is a shift away from everything that we're talking about now. It's called 50 Shades of Brown. Mm-hmm. And that's where you answer a dating question from one of our listeners.
Dating.
So you're already saying a lot of what?
I know. You've been in a long-term relationship. How long now?
A long time. I don't even know. 13 years? 13, 14 years? A long time.
Wow.
Well, I don't know anything about dating. And dating's haram anyway, so go ahead.
Yeah. Said the man who has had a girlfriend / fiance for 13 years.
My fiance forever. That's what I call it. So.
All right. So should you date someone who doesn't want kids when you might want kids?
Was this sent by my
your fiance wrote us in. Fiance, she was like, hey.
I think it really depends how important kids are to you. If you are, if you're agnostic on kids, then you probably don't really want kids. So if you're like, this person doesn't want kids, and I don't know if I want kids or not, so I'm going to date the person. If you're like, having children is part of my identity and the reason I'm on this planet, don't date someone who doesn't want children, because it's going to lead to this difficult compromise later where do you end this relationship to have a child and whatever that brings with it, good and bad. Or do you stay with someone that you love? So I don't think, like, if it's important to you, and again, dating is always about the time in your life where you are. What's important, what's not. If you're just like lightly date, I think the problem is when you're not looking for something serious, so you don't evaluate someone fully, and then it turns into something serious, and you're like, oh my God, I'm stuck in this. Now what do I do? Right, Athea?
I think that happens a lot. I know, he's like, I mean, I was engaged to someone that didn't, well, would flip-flop on the kid issue. And I think that's great advice, with like knowing like how badly you want it. And I used to say, oh, I want kids if my partner also really wants kids. I feel like I could be like swayed. I'm kind of like at a 51% towards having kids. But my ex would like flip-flop on the issue. And I remember it was just like very torturous, because I'm like, what do you want? Just give me, because I want it to be on the table, essentially, and I want it to be something. But that's something we should have worked out before we got engaged. So I would say whatever you like up front, like do it in the beginning. No, first of all, ask yourself what you want about kids, and then you can present that. Because I think even I was and still probably a little bit muddy. And I think it's okay to be like, I actually don't know. But he was like, yes, all for it. Then like, no, I would rather die than have kids. And then he would be like, I don't want to have kids, but I would totally adopt. And I'm like, I don't understand. So you just don't want biological kids, or you just like are putting it as like a faraway concept? Like, yeah, we could adopt kind of
thing. I don't want kids with you, so, I'm saying.
Yeah. So you just don't want my genetics. Is that what it is? Or his,
I would
maybe
adopt someone, but it's interesting. Children discussion, like, it's for some people, having children is so vitally important. But look at the birth rate in America. It's sliding. I think there's a weird thing going on where people don't want to have children, or they're thinking about the finances of having children, or the burdens of having children. Or to me, the most concerning thing about children is that you have a child and you love the child so much. What if the child gets sick or is born with some kind of anomaly, like some kind of disease or something that you've given them, genetics? And that carries on. Like, I'm getting things now as an adult that they're just in genetics. They're not the biggest deal, because our medicine's advanced, and you can be alert to like, oh, everyone in my family, my dad's had diabetes, so I better be alarmed about that going forward. So I have to watch that kind of stuff now a lot more.
Yeah.
So and it's also heartbreaking if anything happens to your child. If you have a child, I don't know how they survive it. So I think through all these negative things as well, I'm like, I don't know.
That's how, I definitely don't. And that's like important to me where like, I've like, for some reason lately been like on dates with people who are like very into like having a family and stuff. And it's like, well, that's not like, I don't see my lifestyle being good for that. And I wouldn't want to ruin a kid's life if it's like, mommy's on the road all the fucking time. And I don't want to do like, I just don't have like that same instinct to like want to have a kid. Which is why I think even right now I'm just like, no dating. I don't want anyone to ruin my life right now. But I think you just have to be like really clear about what you want, like what Athira is saying, because it's so important for you not to like give in to someone else's demands and then just like live a life where you're like, well, I don't know if I really wanted kids. And a lot of people at work end up like, my coworker was like, I didn't want kids. My husband really did, but I guess it's fine. And like some, like when she was pregnant, she was like, I wouldn't wish this on anyone. And I was like, ooh, this is not good for you and your future child. Like, this seems bad.
I guess it's fine is like your answer. Are we going to have dessert with dinner? Yeah, I guess it's, let's have dessert. Now are you going to bring another life into the world? I think it's a definitive commitment to wanting to bring another human life in this world or not. Not like, you know what? I'm going to pass on the second glass of wine. You know, that shouldn't be the attitude as you're going into childhood.
Yeah, it shouldn't be so blasé. But, you know, I almost feel like, you know, if we were back in our respective like homelands from where our parents came from, and it wouldn't be a question. It'd just be, be married with kids, and it's not even something that you'd have to question. And part of me like romanticizes that like non-choice or kind of that conventional lifestyle. I wish I wanted the conventional lifestyle sometimes. Like I wish, because I wouldn't want anything different and I wouldn't know. But I also think people don't question what they actually want and they just go along with societal expectations. And so they don't like what you were saying about like the desperate, like quiet desperation and not like really like asking themselves like, okay, what do I want out of my life? And so either people are actually truly happy in this like conventional lifestyle, which like God bless, you know. I'm all for that, or they're just like deep down not really being honest or questioning what they want out of life, which is a scary thing to me.
I think couples together in long relationships are either happy or too lazy to start over, because the older you get, the more you're like, is it really worth it to start over and share all the weird quirks about myself with someone else? I even joked up with Hen. I'm like, Hen, you're lucky that I'm too lazy to want to start over and go on dating apps and learn about some and have to pretend.
It's brutal. You've got yourself a beautiful Palestinian actress or is like amazing, like sweet person. Yeah, you hold on. Don't go anywhere. The apps are horrendous.
She sounds great from the outside. Live with her for a week, okay?
Let's talk to Hind and see what she has to say. We should talk
Hind's
to her.
She's at home in Haifa now for another week. She'll be home next week. She's in Haifa.
Oh, wow.
She's not seeing her family. She goes every year for a couple of weeks. She had not seen her family in almost 2 years because she was going right before COVID. So then canceled it. So it's almost 2 years not seeing her dad and her brothers. So she stayed a little longer, but she's coming back. So, you know, it's interesting. Hen is the first Palestinian I ever dated. So she's the first person I dated. I didn't have to explain the whole history because they always like, tell me about Palestine. I'm okay. 1947. Sit down.
Yeah, God, it's such an exhausting conversation.
And they're like, I don't understand. I'm like, oh. So with Hen, that was a big plus. I'm like, oh, I don't have to explain the conflict to you. You lived it? Okay, good. Done. So.
And now she's teaching you Arabic, right?
Well, sure, a little bit. But she used it. She thinks I'm stupid, so I can't learn.
You know a few words. I think you know more than,
Well, usually, a little bit. My vocabulary is decent, but my sentence construction, grammar, it's not great. Like, it's like, I'm like a caveman. Like, give me food, you know?
Food, water, bathroom.
Wayne's casual. Like, I'm like a caveman. I'm missing pronouns and verbs.
That's how I speak Urdu. That's like exactly, every time I like speak Urdu with my mom, she's like, this is disgustingly horrendous. And I'm like, I'm trying to like get back to it. I know it's bad.
I'm like, Jashi Hone, I want chicken here.
Chicken now.
That kind of stuff. I really am some kind of Arabic caveman talking about stuff. It's interesting, though, to date someone, because I dated Italians before. And there was no, you don't talk about the history of Italy. Like, there's no conflict going on. But dating someone who's Palestinian, you're dating into a conflict. Like, you're learning about, like, right. dating.
You're dating the whole country.
Like, you're dating a living Discovery Channel. Like, you're going to learn a lot about a whole new world. Athea, you could offer that at a dating profile. If you date me, you'll get smarter about a Middle Eastern conflict. Think about all the things.
I'll add that to my Hinge profile.
There's going to be a lot of woke white people who are going to be like, oh my God, hey.
Right. It's not just dating, but you'll be smarter when it's over. Like,
exactly. We may not make it, but you will be more educated.
Right. It'll be a test at the end of the first date, but still, if you pass it, there might be a date. Tell me what the knock is.
Well, speaking of making people more cultured and telling them about us, we actually, our last segment, Dean, is called Keeping Up with the Caucasians. Oh, no. And since you're half Caucasian, you're perfect for this. You can, and half Arab. So this is a segment where we talk about things that white people do and whether we as people of color also do these things. So let's see where your percentages of white versus Arab are.
Good.
All your talent. Yeah. So here are the different categories you get to choose from. And then I'm going to pick a topic that we're going to ask you about. So we have food, pop culture, activities, music, style and clothes, phrases or sayings, and miscellaneous.
Activities. We'll do activities for 300.
Activities for 300. Have you ever been hang gliding?
Actually, boat on a boat where the parasailing, where you're on that.
I've done that too.
And at the Keys. And with my friend, who's now a member of the United States Congress, he's part of my friend Tom Swazi, a congressman from Long Island. We went to law school together, and we went on spring break with a bunch of guys. And we did that one time, and that one time ever, and that was it. Never doing it again. It was a mistake then. I didn't want to do it. And I did it because I felt like everyone's doing it. It's fun. And I did it. I'm like, that's done. Won't be doing that again.
Was it? Why wouldn't you do it again?
I just felt like, because you were out there on the ocean, and you're coming down, and I had this picture of like of a shark just opening his mouth up, waiting to swallow.
Just waiting for you to land right into it.
And that would be the end of it. Because I have a shark phobia, a really bad one. So I'm like, this is how the shark gets me. Because I'm not dumb enough to go swim out, but he's waiting for me, and this is how he does it. So it wasn't, it was more terrorizing. I didn't enjoy it. Like, to pay for being terrorized,
that's a white thing, like adrenaline sports, like in general, because they haven't lived in conflict or war or anything. They're like, hey, let's get some, you know, let's do some extreme sporting here and
get
my body the feeling like it's going
to
die.
Yeah, you want to be terrorized? Go to a checkpoint in Palestine and have an Israeli soldier point a gun you're paid with your taxpayer dollars at you, which I've had. So I'm like,
boom.
Want to be terrorized there. I have real terror and read about Palestinians having their house stolen in East Jerusalem as we speak now. I guess it's true. White privilege is one of ideas is making up things to scare you. While for us,
exactly. Yes. That's exactly it. And
all this shit where
skydiving, I've never
jumped out of a plane. And you're like, come on,
get out of here.
It's like, have you ever felt like that rush of like, almost dying? Yeah. I've been bombed in Palestine. I know exactly what that feels like. Thank you. I don't need to jump out of a plane. I've had one.
When I was in Palestine, I heard,
into my house.
First time I heard like guns, bullets fired by people fighting, like a little battle. I've never heard that in my life in New York. I've never even heard a gunshot. I live in New York, but all the crime. I'm sure there are sections where you might hear it, but it's still rare, that kind of stuff. But I heard like actual battle going on between militants and the Israeli military when I was in Ramallah. And I looked freaked out and people were like, it's nothing. Like, don't worry about it. That's nothing. That'll go. And
those are just, what do they call it? Clashes on the border. Yeah, right. You're fine. There's just like clash. That's what, Well, the media also, like the way they portray it too, it just like, it makes it sound like it's not, you know, nothing serious, or it's like an equal, two equal opposing forces.
No.
Which is so fucked up. Amama, have you been hang gliding?
No, I can't even like swim. So let's not.
Really?
Yeah.
You can't swim?
But I like still like in Puerto Rico and I went on a kayak and the guy like later, like we all got drinks and he was like, wait a minute, you said you couldn't swim? And I was like, yeah, but I had a life vest on. And that's like the like riskiest thing I've done. But no, I've not done any of that. I have no interest in doing any of that. I think
maybe I can. Okay.
I like rock climbing. It's like the only thing I do that you. Yeah.
Yeah, we're going to Miami next week and doing shows and stuff. So maybe I can convince you to go jet skiing or parasailing was fun. I mean, it was a little terrifying, to be honest, but I felt
I think with kayaking, it wasn't like I was like in like the fucking ocean. If I go jet skiing and I fall, I'm done.
Not with a life vest.
Jet skiing is fun. That's different. And that's probably a white person's thing. But jet skiing I've done a few times. You go to Miami for shows. That's fun. That's cool.
Yeah. Taking the no fly list on the road.
Ironically, that's irony.
Yeah.
We should really drive there instead of fly.
Oh my God, yeah.
To really commit. but Dean, thank you so much for being on. You know, anything that you want to plug, your SiriusXM show, or where our listeners can follow you and find you?
Sure. Well, I have a show on SiriusXM channel 127, 6 to 9 p.m. weeknights. Weekdays, I should say, and it's politics, but there's some humor here and there. Theories on Friday, we do some humor, and
it's so fun.
I have a Twitter at Dean Obidal or facebook.com/Dean of Radio, and I have a weekly newsletter. If you want to be on it, it's free. I'll never ask you for money. Dean@deanofradio.com. Send me an email, I'll put you on the list. It comes out Sunday. It's got some stuff about news of the week, and I promise to make you smarter and make you laugh or at least smile each week within 5 minutes. It's a quick read. Newsletter. So people want to do that. And we're going to have another Brown show, Big Brown Comedy Show in mid-August. I have the date. I just got it. So I'll have to tell you not sure. I don't want to say the wrong date here. It's mid-August. I just got it confirmed from the comic strip.
I'll post about it. Yeah. Once we have it. That's awesome. I'm so glad it's back. And I really hope we do the Arab Fest this year.
No, we have Gotham booked. We already have Gotham booked.
Is it? Oh my God.
So we're booked. Yes. So we don't know by the fall if there's going to be a COVID uptick or not, I think we're at 100% capacity. And
amazing. And we're all vaccinated. November, if you're not now, then go away.
Uptick, but let's hope not.
Let's hope not. Yeah. That's awesome. Yes, please follow Dean. Follow us at No Fly List Pod. Follow me at Ether Yaku.
And you can follow me at Amama Cigar. Thank you so much for listening.
Thanks, guys.
Thanks, Dean.
Thank you. Thank you.